gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I am your host, Ken Molman, and this is the My View Matters Radio Network. Got a few things queued up tonight to talk about. If you'd like to call in about any of the topics or anything liberty-related in the state of Kentucky, you can feel free to do so by calling area code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. So I guess to start out, I hope everybody had a safe and happy 4th of July. I know I was pretty much drenched in any way. Anything I did, it did not seem to stop raining since the 4th. And in fact, it's rained here yet again today. And I assume, I know it was raining in other places too. I talked to some folks down in Lexington on the 4th. It was pouring down rain and various places throughout the state. It's been raining. And even outside the state of Kentucky, just nonstop rain. And lots of flooding in some of the cities where the sewer systems just couldn't handle that much rain, and especially on the low ground where all the water eventually rolls to. So hope everybody is, well, hope those that are had a flood in their homes or in their streets or whatever have cleaned up, and hopefully the rain will stop. I'm hoping that I get to actually mow my entire yard before it starts raining someday in the near future. So that's a little bit frustrating, to say the least. You know, speaking of the 4th of July, I saw a story, and I saw some of this for the last couple of years on Facebook and different people talking about it. One of the things that's interesting is that the fireworks are actually sources of issues for some of our veterans who suffer from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, the explosions and whatnot remind or cause flashbacks for those soldiers who were in combat zones. And I guess the point is that it's kind of unfortunate, obviously, on a day that celebrates our freedom, our soldiers who ostensibly joined the military to defend our country are often left cowering in fear and disturbed by the festivities. And I guess that's just kind of a reminder that, or yet another reminder that we should go to war only when necessary and should do so quickly and decisively and get done and not have half a generation full of veterans like we have today, which is unfortunate. But I guess it was just kind of an interesting thing with the PTSD and 4th of July, and something that I find interesting, but also very sad. And the irony there that celebrations of our freedoms are not so festivus for those of who have gone and enlisted in the military and served in the military. On a brighter side, I found an interesting story online about the 10 things or whatever that can make you happy. What can make you a happier person? And it's kind of a correlation thing, right? It's not specific to any one particular life or lifestyle or whatever. But just in general, the traits of the happiest people. One of the interesting things is that the countries ranked in order of satisfaction with life, starting with the best. Costa Rica is first, then Denmark, Iceland, Switzerland, Norway, Finland, Mexico, Sweden, Canada, and Panama. And I thought that was kind of interesting. But the things that you should do to make yourself happier are also pretty interesting. Based on the collated data, right, it's all collation, it's not individual. If you're in a long-term relationship, if you're actively engaged in politics, if you're active in your work and in your free time, if you go out for dinner, if you have close friendships, which is not necessarily a lot of friends, but close friends. Some of the things that they found to be surprising, which aren't necessarily so surprising to me, people who drink in moderation are happier than those who don't drink at all. as one who drinks in moderation and has seen people who don't drink at all, I understand that completely. Men tend to be happier in a society where women enjoy greater equality. And that's interesting. There's lots of theories why I could come up with why that might be, but that's not the point. Being good looking increases men's happiness more than it does women's happiness. You tend to be happier if you think you're good looking, even if you're not. That's kind of a funny one. And the last one is that having children lowers your happiness level, but it increases as they grow up and leave the home. So it's kind of interesting, too. Let's see here. Yeah, and the rest of the story got cut off. So anyway, just kind of some of the interesting things that you can do to make your life happier. You know, and I guess part of the interesting thing is the actively engaged in politics part. And, you know, we obviously are very active in politics here on the show, and I'm very active outside of the show as well. I just find that very interesting that in the aggregate, collated data, being actively engaged in politics does make one happier, which I think does make sense in a way. And I think that maybe that would encourage people to get more involved in politics. So let's see here. Some of the other interesting things that have come about. I think we talked about this last week about the redistricting lawsuits and the special session's been called for August 19th for redistricting. And I'm anxious to see this come together. One of the things that folks are worried about is that special sessions have been used for other things as well, beyond just the issue that they're called for. And in fact, I did do a little bit of research and looked at the previous session was supposed to be about the budget, the previous special session. And there were some other things that were thrown in as well. And specifically, some of my smoking ban fight are concerned that they're going to try to cram a smoking ban through during the special session. Now, I don't think that's going to work. I hope that doesn't work, and we'll see how that goes. I am obviously on top of that. Those that don't know, I'm involved with a group called Northern Kentucky Choice. It is a issue advocacy group, and really it's more of a education group that goes out and teaches the public about smoking bans and disputes some of the FUD and sillinesses that the pro-ban people put out there. I mean, if what the pro-ban people actually said were true, you'd see dead bodies littering the sidewalks of the streets of every major city. It's rather ridiculous. And, of course, there have been a number of articles in the paper lately, in various papers throughout the state, promoting smoking bans and blah, 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 which is why people are a little bit nervous that perhaps that might get tacked on. Usually preceding any legislative action, there's an increase in the number of stories in the media talking about it where the establishment bureaucracy or establishment political powers try to push their agenda through the media. And so with good reason, people are concerned, and I'll be keeping an eye on that, I'm sure, as well as others. And I'll keep this audience up to date on what's going on that front as well as things occur. Speaking of the bureaucracy, something I found kind of interesting. There is a fight going on in North Carolina where a guy has a blog, and in his blog he promotes what's known as the paleo diet. Now, not everybody's heard of the paleo diet, or maybe they have. I'm not a big health nut, and if you've met me, you know that. But the paleo diet is the idea behind it is get away from the processed foods and the modern foods and go back to things that would have been eaten in a more primitive time without the mass manufacturing of foods being made possible. And so it's also referred to as the caveman diet. Anyhow, the North Carolina Board of Dietetics, what a weird word, and Nutrition specifically sought to censor this guy's blog. I mean, it's so weird that the bureaucracy would go after a blog. They must have really had nothing going on. but they went after a blog. They asked him to censor a bunch of information. You know, obviously a blog, like any media outlet, can be biased, and blogs are more like the old style of journalism that existed when our country began, which is now known as yellow journalism. It's known as yellow journalism because yellow paper was cheaper, it yellowed, and it wasn't the higher quality, lighter colored paper, and was more prevalent for people who would hand out their own news items to push some sort of agenda or whatever. And make no mistakes, blogs are pretty much the same thing. They're a modern version of the media as it existed at the time of the signing of the Constitution. And that's important because when the courts look at issues, they have to look at intent. And certainly the media at the time of the founding of the country was not the media of today. Times do change. But the media was very free to say whatever they so chose. It was the media. And it's very interesting. It actually had the media had a profound effect on the early years of the country, up to and including the publishing of the Federalist Papers, which if you know anything about the history of the country and how we ended up with a constitution, the Federalist Papers were published in newspapers around the United States, and essentially those newspapers helped push the public policy that ended up in our Constitution and getting popular support for switching from the Articles of Confederation, which had existed first, to the Constitution. So the point is, this blog is being, well, they were told a bureaucracy tried to, I don't know why I can't speak today. I apologize, folks. But this blog was told to censor information by a bureaucracy in North Carolina. And essentially, the Institute for Justice got involved. This thing's gone up to federal court now. We're at the Fourth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. And this is just amazing. The board asked him to change and remove portions of his website. If he refused, they said that he would face jail time. The Institute for Justice got involved. So they got involved and they sued the state on behalf of the gentleman with the blog, saying that we're violating his rights. A U.S. district judge dismissed the case and said that there was no harm that had been done and that he could not show harm, therefore he did not have standing in court. And this recent ruling by the circuit court reverses that dismissal, and so the case will go on, the lawsuit continues, which is a good thing. We need to have the courts take a more proactive role in defending our rights, and it's unfortunate that lately it seems like you have to prove that you're being specifically harmed, you as the individual being specifically harmed, and especially when it comes to some of these Fourth Amendment cases that we've had lately, it's impossible to prove because the information is not available to prove whether or not you're being spied upon. And if you're not being spied upon, if you can't prove that you're being spied upon, then the courts have been throwing those cases saying you have no standing. And that's a catch-22 scenario with the courts. It's horrible. So I'm glad to see that the courts are allowing that to move forward. Anytime our rights are violated in any way, shape, or form, the courts could be at least willing to hear the case and, if they rule one way or the other, it's another story. But when it comes to our civil liberties, it is important that the courts work as that third branch of government that keeps the legislative and executive branches in check. So switching gears entirely, one of the things that has come out here in the past few days is that our gas tax is going up. And so the way in Kentucky our gas tax is indexed is the price from the wholesaler to the retailer, I believe. I know it's a wholesaler price thing. And essentially what happens is as the price goes up, instead of changing it on a daily basis, the tax, What they do is they look at the quarterly aggregate. So how much was the price on average across the last 3 months? And at that time, they then figure out, okay, well, gas was, let's say, $3.75 a gallon on average for the past 3 months. So we're going to make the tax whatever number of cents per gallon. Now, I believe it was 2009, and I'm trying real hard to remember this, but I want to say it was in early 2009 during the General Assembly session. What ended up happening was gas prices, if you remember back in 2008, just before the election, was the first time that gas prices topped $4 a gallon. And so our gas taxes had gone up and up and up and up and up leading up to that. And so the state was collecting more and more cents per gallon than they ever had before because that was indexed on that price. Now, what happened was when the price dropped back off, and if you remember back in January and February of 2009, the price dropped back to $2 a gallon. It's like $1.89 to $1.99 a gallon for a good solid 2 months. And I guess the point is that what that was going to do was basically cut what the state was getting in half, right? Because now instead of being $4 a gallon, it's $2 a gallon, and the state's got to drop their tax to match that. Well, that's a huge cut to the gas, the road fund, the fuel tax revenue the state brings in. So to solve that problem, what they did, and this is I hate when the bureaucracy and when legislators do this. What they did was they increased the tax rate, which made it so that instead of the price the tax per gallon decreasing as it should have, what happened was they increased that rate so that the dollar amount, the pennies on the dollar per gallon, increased, they stayed the same. So even though it was supposed to go down, they changed the rate so they would continue to collect the same amount per gallon. And make no mistake, it was Republicans and Democrats that were behind this. And the Republicans up here in northern Kentucky at the time very quickly justified it as, well, it's not a tax increase because it's still the same amount of money coming out of your pocket per gallon. And I get really frustrated with that because inevitably, of course, here we are 4 or 5 years later, gas prices have gone up again, and we're almost at $4 a gallon again. But now, as a result of the increased tax rate, they didn't lower the tax rate again once we got back up to this number. Of course not. And so what we see here, in effect, is that in Kentucky versus Ohio, the price per gallon is 15 on average across both states, Kentucky and Ohio. The average price in Ohio is $3.35 per gallon. In Kentucky, the price is $3.50 per gallon. And the gas prices will continue to be higher in Kentucky. The gas tax itself is a full 4 cents per gallon higher than Ohio's. Ohio's is 28 cents a gallon. Kentucky's is 32 cents a gallon. Now, all that said, if the gas tax was really being completely used in an efficient manner to maintain our state-owned highways, I wouldn't really complain all that much about it. I mean, at the end of the day, that's ideally what's supposed to happen, is that the fuel tax is collected. And we've talked about this on the show, larger vehicles do more damage to the roads, but they also use more gas, so they end up spending more sending more tax revenue to the state per gallon, which is translates to miles driven. And smaller cars, which do far less damage, send fewer dollars to the state on an annual basis for the road usage of the roads. And I guess my problem here is that essentially Kentucky has the highest tax rate that it's had. Right? We're at almost $4 a gallon, $3.50 a gallon, but we're collecting of that 32 cents a gallon is tax to the state. And so essentially there's a 10% premium on the price per gallon, right? So we're paying 10% more of the actual price, including federal taxes, to the state. Now, my question is, where's that money going? And this kind of leads into where I was going to go next here. There's a big push again to try to get these public-private partnerships going again, where the state allows private industry to build infrastructure and collect fees for its use. And these are on top of the fees already being paid to the state. Right? So in the particular case here in Northern Kentucky, they're talking about tolls for a replacement bridge for I-75. I-75 is one of the most critical corridors in the United States, the economic corridors, I should say. And essentially, they want to put tolls on this, and they want the private company to pay or to build this and let the private company collect these tolls over time. Now, of course, as a private company, any profits they get are going to be taxed, so the state still gets their pound of flesh out of it too. But the point is that where's all this fuel tax money going? I mean, if we're collecting a record amount per gallon, where's it going? I'd really like to know. And in theory, the amount per gallon that's being spent, right, is more gas tax revenue is generated where the population actually drives. In other words, and no offense to my friends out in Western Kentucky, but Western Kentucky Parkway is built to a standard the same as I-71. I got two people in the queue now. Guys, I'll get to you in just a moment. I-71 is built, and it's a very well-traveled corridor between Louisville and Cincinnati, heavily, heavily traveled. And you, in turn, look at the Western Kentucky Parkway, which is built to the same specs, and by comparison, far fewer vehicles on that highway. Now, in theory, since the gas tax is being collected based on the miles driven and where the traffic is, in theory, there should be more money going into I-71 per mile than the Western Kentucky Parkway. It should be done by the amount of traffic and where the gas tax is being generated from, in my opinion. All right, I'm going to pull these calls in order. You guys called in like 3 seconds apart from each other. So let's see here. This one's 859. Go ahead, caller.
Hey, how you doing, Ken? It's Randolph Vance.
Hey, Randolph. How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing all right. You know what? I've been contemplating running for Congress again next year. Just got a kind of a quick question. Is it okay to collect petition signatures now, or do you have to wait until 2014 to do it?
What I can tell you for sure is that any candidate who wants to run for office next year cannot affix a signature to any petition, and this includes Republicans and Democrats that only have to get two, but for independents and third parties like you and I, Randolph, we cannot affix any signatures to any petition until the first Wednesday after the first Monday in November of the year preceding the election. So in other words, this year we can't start collecting signatures until November 6th.
Okay. Well, then that makes sense. I was worried that I was going to have to start in January, but I could probably start it right around Thanksgiving and then get at least a good couple months head start on it. So,
absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely doable.
Yeah.
And folks, for those that don't know, Randolph Vance, he ran for Congress as an independent in 2012 against Andy Barr and Ben Chandler. And Randolph, you ran a very low budget campaign because, you know, is in typical
low
form,
budget,
no one
to
ever.
Say the least. Yes.
You mean that a company didn't drop $1 million in your lap? What?
Oh, no. You know what? I only spent $650. $500 of that was the filing fee.
I understand the first race that I ever helped with was a congressional race, and it was a $750 race. So I completely understand where you're coming from on that.
Yeah. I'm kind of considering it because, you know what, Andy Barr has been really strangely silent about the whole warrantless wiretapping that's coming out because of what Edward Snowden blew the whistle on. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, and in fact,
yeah.
Well, and that's, I'll tell you, a lot of our legislators have been kind of eerily quiet. It's kind of interesting. I don't know if they're just waiting to see how this falls out, if they're waiting for public opinion, if they're, you know, trying to figure out some way to shape public opinion, and in the meantime they're staying quiet. I don't really understand why. To me, it's a pretty cut and dry issue. Our government should not be spying on people without cause. That we've talked about that extensively on the show in the past. That due process is critical to
what
the entire
gets me
system
is that
we have.
Democrats who were against Bush doing exactly what Obama's doing are now for what Obama's doing. It's frightening the Constitution means nothing unless it's the other guy doing the illegal wiretapping.
I understand completely. Randolph, do you mind? I'm going to put you back in the hold queue. We have another caller that wants to talk.
Sure.
And then we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'll talk to you in the break and see what else you've got. And, yeah, just hang on a second. Let me get this other caller in before the bottom of the hour break. Thanks for calling in, though, and just hang on there. All right, 502 area code. You're off hold and here. How you doing?
Hi, Ken. Paul Holliger calling from Louisville.
Hey, Paul. How you doing, my friend?
Life's always interesting in my world. How about yours?
Oh, likewise. You know, it's another day and another rainstorm, another monsoon rolled through here. I don't know about down there in Louisville lately, but it hadn't stopped raining up here in about a week.
Well, it's been raining, and it's been raining. I've been raining lies as it relates to the Ohio River Bridges project here in Louisville. Now, since you guys up in northern Kentucky are facing a very similar situation, I don't know how far along your situation is as far as are you in the early stages, middle stages, or end game, but I'm going to tell you guys that the people here in the Louisville area on these bridges projects, they have changed their story at every stage to fit what they want. And if you compare what we ended up with versus what they originally were selling the public, you would conclude that these people were engaged in a full-fledged deceit campaign from the outset. From the outset. The tolling issue that you were referring to for the I-75 replacement bridge, the tolling would make sense on the new bridge, but do you know on the existing I-65 bridge here in Louisville, the one that's been around for almost 40 years and surely by now must be fully paid for, will become a tolled bridge when the new bridge finally does open up. So they're going to take an existing free bridge and turn it into a toll bridge.
Now, my understanding, and Paul, we'll have to look into this, but it's my understanding that it is against federal law to take an existing federal highway that is not tolled, add tolls to it. And I'd be very interested to find out how they're going to get around that, because that was one of the things here that was talked about. And, originally one of the ideas was they were going to put the toll gates way far away from the actual bridge itself. And the idea behind that is that there's not a lot of room. I mean, where are you going to put these toll booths, right? And that idea quickly died, and then it turned into, well, we're going to have traffic cameras that take a snapshot of your car, and every car that goes across the bridge goes into some database and sends you a bill once a month.
That variation there is, in fact, what the current iteration of the toll bridges in Louisville it contains. Okay, initially, you know, they were talking about no tolls. And then they started talking about, well, it's only going to be $1 a car. Well, now we're up to $2 and $3 a car per trip. They've been deceitful every step of the way, every step. So whatever you guys are hearing up in northern Kentucky, I will assure you they're following the model that was successfully used in the Louisville area, which means you guys are being deceived every time one of those proponents opens their mouth.
Well, and we are seeing some of exactly what you said. We're seeing that originally the bridge was going to cost $2 billion and the toll was going to be a dollar for cars, for regular, you know, car vehicles, non-commercial. And it's now gone, it went from $2 billion to $2.4 billion to $2.7 billion. And it did that roughly in about a three-month span. And so my joke was every month we used to add $3 billion on every month and say, well, the bridge is obviously going to cost this much more this month because we waited another month. And they keep beating that drum up here. Oh, the longer you wait, the more expensive it gets. Well, the only reason that would actually be true is that inflation occurs. I mean, it's not like, oh, well, if we buy it today, it's on sale, but tomorrow it's off sale and back at full price. And I have, honestly, Paul, my big problem with the toll bridges really is that you have what is essentially the state granting a monopoly to a private corporation. And we've seen, first of all, that when this happens, it's going to be some crony of some political somebody or other. I mean, that's pretty much a given. It's not really going to be an open bid process, or they'll narrow it down so much that only two or three favored folks have any shot of hitting it. But more importantly, Chicago just sold all of their parking to a public-private partnership. 99-year lease. Now, that sounds like a smart idea, right? 99-year lease on every parking spot in Chicago. And over the course of the past 3 years, the price has tripled, and it now costs up to $20 an hour. The average is $7 an hour to park in Chicago. Now imagine, that's what, per day, an eight-hour workday, it's $56 to $160 a day to park your car to work. That's crazy. And it's a legal contract, there's nothing the city can do. They throw their hands up and go, whoops, sorry.
Ken, we got the same game plan in effect here in Jefferson County, Kentucky. It's the same game plan. It's the same game. Listen, there's one thing about these guys. We always worried a long time ago about the possible organized crime setting up their business in our communities. Well, guess what, gang? They didn't have to set up their business operations in communities. They simply took over government, because that's what it appears to me. Government today is a form of organized crime, and the politicians who get elected are part and parcel of that. That's why there's all this big money in this. That's why the little guy, that's why independents and little guys. And Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is just kind of one of those nice stories that, you know, you can tell folks about, but the chances of it ever happening again are quite remote. They're quite remote because of that. So,
and it is, well, and a few other things, too, that are, you know, the same kind of thing. And, Paul, I'm going to put you back in the queue for a minute, my friend. We need to take a bottom-of-the-hour break here. Hang on just a moment here. And, folks, you are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network. If you'd like to call in about any of the topics we've talked about or anything on the agenda, you can do so at code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. And we'll be right back right here on the My View Matters Radio Network.
Victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springson of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
All right, folks, and we are back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network. It is Sunday night. And if you're listening to this on podcast, we are here live every Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern time, and would love to have you listen live and participate in the show. We have the chat room that's open if people want to talk in there. And coming back onto the show, I'm bringing back Paul Holliker from Louisville. Paul, you're with Stop It, right? The Stop Invisible Taxes?
Stop Invisible Taxes, and we've got a number of projects underway up here, and I'm not going to use a lot of valuable show time detailing all of them. But the fact is that our plate is just chock full of opportunities. There are so many opportunities to expose fraud, waste, and abuse. But let's stay with the bridge issue for just a moment, if you don't mind, Ken, because you're talking, your group's up there in Northern Kentucky, you're talking $2 and $3 billion worth of dollars. Here in the Louisville and Jefferson County area, they're talking billions of dollars for two new bridges. You know, in between, just about halfway between Northern Kentucky and Louisville, are a couple of communities in two different states. One's over in Madison, Indiana. The other one is in Milton, Kentucky. They are in the process right now of replacing a bridge between those two communities. I think it's on US 421. that runs between those two cities. But they're replacing a bridge over the same Ohio River that your community and my community has to cross and has to put new bridges in. And they are doing a brand new bridge built to federal highway specs for the amazingly low price of only $100 million. And they're going to be bringing it in ahead of schedule and likely a little bit under budget. $100 million. Now, Ken, do the math. For $2 billion or $3 billion, how many two-lane bridges could they possibly build across the Ohio River?
Let's see.
Yeah.
That's what, 20?
20
hey,
or 30.
Hey, that's 40 lanes of highway. That's pretty good.
20 or 30, which would actually improve traffic flow in your area. And they could probably, if they brought it in, let's just say they decided to put only 10 of those two-lane bridges there. That's 20 additional lanes, and it's only $1 billion. It's only $1 billion as opposed to what they're doing now. Now, so Ken, you know, kind of tying into what you are been talking about, if Madison and Milton and two totally different states can get together and put a bridge project together, built a federal highway specs for $100 million or less, what in the hell is going on in the urban centers of Northern Kentucky and Louisville, Kentucky? What's going on here?
I can't answer that question. I often question myself, why is it that this bridge costs so much money? What I'm being told is that a third of what that is, the cost of the bridge up here that they're proposing, is redoing how it's connected to the highway. That, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $700,000 or so of the money is being used or is for changing the on-ramps and off-ramps and that kind of stuff. But, you know, I mean, you're talking about essentially a mile of highway on each side of the river at the most that has to be modified. So you're talking about 2 miles of highway and a bridge, and I really can't see how much or how it's that much money. And like I said, my big problem with this, even if you can show me the numbers and say, look, here's why it costs this much money, and you can, you know, outline all that to me, my real concern is that what you're looking at is basically an infinite lease to a private organization of that bridge. And that lease it's not even really a lease. It's more of a lease of the rights, right, the land rights, to build in that spot. And it creates a monopoly for that really doesn't have any sort of check and balance. There's nothing that says, hey, company XYZ who owns this bridge, you're not allowed to charge a $10 per car toll. What stops that? There's nothing that stops that from happening.
Well,
and that's really my main concern.
Yeah. What was supposed to stop it are the people that we collectively, and I say that with great reservation because I don't take credit for electing any of these clowns that are in there, but we the people put people in the jobs, and that's one of their job functions is to protect us as a community. Here in Louisville, we have a project that's known as the Galleria, and I understand there's several Gallerias around the United States, but this particular Galleria is in the core business district in the downtown area. And there was a company that was given a 99-year lease on this place, similar to what you're describing. Their name is Cordish, C-O-R-D-I-S-H, and they're out of Maryland. And the Cordish operation is so much like organized crime. It's unbelievably like organized crime. We had to send a delegation because we weren't getting some accountability, and the delegation of 5 sitting Metro Council people went to Maryland, and before they would even talk to them, the Cordish people had them sign a confidentiality agreement stating that they cannot go back home and talk about any of the details that were discussed.
Yeah, and
so
here's the thing. The public-private partnership, in my opinion, is the worst of both worlds, right? If it's a truly private enterprise thing, right, That means that there's going to be competition or can be competition. So if the price gets too high or quality gets too bad or whatever, right, another company can come and compete with it. That's real private sector. The public sector is all about monopolizing something, but there's accountability through the ballot box. There's transparency in the laws that require open records, right? The Open Records Act, Freedom of Information Act, those type of things require transparency, and we have the check and balance of, in theory, being able to kick people out of office once they get too way off the track. The point is, though, that in a public-private partnership, what we're essentially doing is saying, here, public or private corporation, you build this and you get the profit, and on the public side, we're going to grant you a monopoly. We're going to protect your ability to profit from this. We're going to take the liability in on the public side. So we've taken away all the liability, all the risk, all the dangers of a typical corporation. And so this is nothing more than straight-up corporatism. It's socializing loss and privatizing profit. And it's a terrible, terrible thing to have this. I would have no problem, honestly, it would be a better scenario if the state owned the bridge and hired someone to operate it in some way, right, or any asset, instead of these public-private partnerships. In your Galleria example, it would be better if the Galleria had been leased, management. They had hired whatever company to manage the properties, right, who then can be fired if they screw it up or make the patrons upset, right?
Wait,
in that scenario, then the city – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Now, let me throw another twist into this mix, Ken, and this is something that you know, and I think that your listeners to your show also know this, but it's something that I need to say, and that is here in the Louisville, Kentucky area, our local politics are dominated by the Democrat Party. And I think up in northern Kentucky, the Democrats may have some sway, but do the Republicans dominate up in northern Kentucky?
Republicans dominate up here.
Okay, so my point here is that anyone who honestly believes that there is a fundamental difference between the Democrat Party and the Republican Party when it comes to cronyism, they are just flat living in a dream world, because at that level, this capitalistic cronyism transcends the two major parties, and therefore that's the real problem area. The two major parties don't want anyone else to participate, like libertarians, independents,
right,
and that's why they control the game. So again, I don't want any of your listeners who think that their particular party of choice is the superior party, I don't want them to go around feeling real smug, because I'm going to tell you, the Democrats and the Republicans, when it comes to corporate cronyism, they are identical. They're identical.
Yeah.
And the people they're screwing is everyone that's in our society.
Well, and what's amazing is that, in general, it used to be it was corporation versus corporation, you know, using the parties as their puppets. But at this point, it's even the same corporations just controlling the same things. And you're at the point where there are certain corporations that just control everything going on. And whether it's Republican or Democrat, they really don't care. It doesn't matter if Republicans or Democrats are in charge. They've put in the right contributions. They've made sure that their guy got in through the primary on either side and made sure that their guy won. And, you know, that's really the only thing that's really kind of changed, at least in northern Kentucky. There are a handful of folks that got in through the Tea Party surge, you know, a couple of years ago, or I guess almost 4 years ago now, that were not part of that plan. And certainly there is the push to get those people back out and replace them with the ones that are favored. But the point is you're exactly right. Republican or Democrat, in general, there is an establishment, and I use that as an all-encompassing term, and the establishment doesn't care what political party you are in. The establishment doesn't care what the constituents are. They figure out, oh, this is a Republican area? Well, then we need to get our guy in through the Republican Party. Oh, this is a Democrat area? Well, we need to get our guy in through the Democratic Party. And make no mistake, we've seen in northern Kentucky, as the time has changed and we went from a predominantly Democrat area to a predominantly Republican area, the same politicians are there. They just change parties along the way with the change. And so the establishment lives on, and the politicians live on.
Back in pre-World War II Italy, there was a little guy who came to power. His name was Mussolini. And some of the younger listeners here may not know that because they probably didn't get taught that in their public education camps that they had to attend. But Mussolini actually practiced what you refer to as corporatism. If you take a look in the dictionary, a synonym for corporatism is called fascism. And that's basically where corporations and business are, in fact, running the government. Running the government, okay? So your private-public partnership, call it corporatism, call it fascism, call it what you want, but I'm going to tell you this, they don't give a rat's ass about how they enslave us financially. And we're going to have to figure out how much enslavement we're willing to take. Right now, one of the things that I do like seeing is that people are beginning to chafe a bunch at the financial burdens being put upon them by all sorts of regulations and government intrusion into their lives. And you know, what we see it down here, they want to impose more and more regulations on everything. The Democrat Metro Council, they believe in making a law against that or for that, and every time they do, we're talking dollars and cents being taken out of the community's personal pockets. So the good news is we are racing down that road where there'll be enough in numbers to say enough's enough, we're fighting back. That's the good news. The bad news is I just don't know when that day is going to get here.
I'm with you, and I agree completely. We are reaching a point where more and more voters are more and more keenly aware that the Republican and Democrat establishments, and really they're the same establishment, is not looking out for their best interest, and that they are not the people they claim to be. And more people are more and more upset all the time. You know, we see the demographics with Obama having lost a lot of the youth support because all the things he promised, where are they at? They haven't shown up. You see Republicans that join the Republican Party because of this big talk of liberty, only to be basically kicked out and railroaded out of the party by the ones in control of it. You see more and more people becoming fully aware of what is going on, or at least fully aware of the outside, you know, what can be easily seen of what's going on, and getting more and more frustrated. And I think that as the funny part is that the establishment now and the bureaucracy, which really the bureaucracy is the establishment and vice versa, the bureaucracy doesn't understand the pushback, and they're actually just redoubling their push. And that's kind of the funniest part to me, is that the bureaucracy doesn't even realize what they're doing to themselves, and that by pushing harder to try to push through the opposition, they're actually creating an even bigger pushback. And so we've seen that in lots of different ways. But in the past, it used to be one or two voices. And, Paul, I know you know this. In the past, one or two voices in the wilderness saying, whoa, hey, don't do this to us. It's not right. And the bureaucracy was able to run those people directly over with their machine steamroller and just push stuff through, and the majority of the public didn't even know what was going on. Now, when somebody stands up and says, this is wrong and this is why it's wrong, more people pay attention, the word gets out. They still run you over with the steamroller and they're still going to do it, but at least the people do see, hey, wait a second, that guy was right when he said that we didn't have to spend $2.7 billion on a bridge and be stuck with, you know, tolls for the next decade or century. You know, that's where, over time, the bureaucracy is losing its credit because it is not listening to the people.
Well, it's being reactionary, Ken, and I think that that those that are in the political elite, which are the ones that are in control of the bureaucracy, the political class, as I've heard them referred to, they really honestly believe that what is happening over in places like Egypt and Syria and Afghanistan, that all of that stuff will not come home to roost here. And because of that, every time they get a little pushback, as you stated, they want to tighten the screws down a little bit more. Well, the very nature of human beings, particularly a society like this where our heritage is freedoms of all different kinds, they will reach a point where they step over the line, and I don't know how the pushback is going to manifest itself right now. I will not rule out the possibility of a violent pushback should the provocation be sufficient. Okay, I would hope that we could simply take care of it through nonviolent means, but I will tell you, I won't rule anything out. Look what's happening in Egypt. Egypt had at one time a Western-style civilization moderated by Islam, okay? But it wasn't a militant Islam like this Morsi guy was trying to reintroduce. And the folks over there who've had a taste of a Western-style democracy and Western-style freedom, they said, we're not taking this crap anymore. And we're going to reach that point, too, here. We will. I just don't know when.
And I'll tell you honestly, Paul, I've had the same thought for years that, you know, the train we're on is the train to a violent uprising. And my main motivation in politics, above all others, has been to try to stop that by solving the problems that I see as what are going to be the inevitable causes of said revolt. And I think that there is a very peaceful means of resolving many of these issues today. Now, if we wait another decade, it may be too late. If we wait another 5 years, it may be too late. I don't know the answer to when it becomes too late, when there's no turning back. But for now, we have the ability to put the right people in office. We have the ability to get control of this monster. We have that ability right now. And so I guess the point is that, and I just noticed we're about out of time for the show. Jeez, Paul, I'm going to put you back on hold. Thanks for calling, man. I appreciate it. Folks, the point is that we have the means to get control of this monster, both of the local, state, and federal level. We can take all of it, but it takes us being aware of who we're actually putting in office and what do they really stand for. Are they someone who's really looking out for your interests, or are they looking out for the interests of the entrenched political powers? And it's really not that hard to figure out once you know what to look for. And the more you pay attention to politics, the more you know what to look for. When somebody starts talking about giving sweetheart monopolistic deals to companies, that's that's one of the big warning signs. Oh, really? You're going to give all our money to a private company and not let us have a choice? Yeah, good luck. Folks, that's another edition of Books. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in again next week, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, My View Matters Radio Network. Have a good week.